Well, please be seated and take your notes and join me in Mark chapter 3. Mark chapter 3. As we were singing all these songs here this morning and thinking about the choir that will be singing for us tonight, I was reflecting on a TV show that perhaps some of you have seen called The Voice. Anybody here seen The Voice? And it's a very interesting show. It's a singing competition. And at the beginning, there's these four kind of singing superstars up on these chairs with their backs to the people that are singing. They call those the blind auditions. And these folks start singing, and if they like them, they hit a button and turn their chair around. And their hope is that these people that they like a lot will become a member of their team. And so if you have a particular star like Blake Shelton, he'll say he wants him to be on team what? Team Blake. Or there's three others up there, Team Shakira, Team whoever. So they have these different teams, and these singers get the chance, if more than one turns around, they get to pick which team they're going to be on. Well, we're going to see something similar to that today, except with a slightly different twist. After the Lord Jesus picks who's on his team, they don't get to pick whether or not they want to be on the team. When he picks you to be on his team, you're on his team, right? Now, you do need to get close to him and follow him, but he calls us to be on his team. So I've entitled the message today, Team Jesus. Have you ever thought about that? You're on Team Jesus? Are you? Are you a follower of his? Are you on his team? See, this is a glorious thing to contemplate, that we get to be on the team that's going to ultimately win. And Jesus will indeed win it all. That's Mark's whole point. He started that out in chapter 1, verse 1, by saying that this is the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he goes on to say, the Son of who? God. So as the Son of God, he's going to win. And if we end up aligning with him, no matter how many other people are against him, to be on Jesus' side is to be on the winning team. And so as we flow through the text so far, we've seen Jesus coming and doing mighty things, calling people to follow him, teaching them how to fish, emphasizing that it's not a religion but a relationship, and then pointing out that the old way of religion, the old way of the Pharisees and the scribes and others, that old way didn't work. In fact, it was useless. And so he came to show that he was going to bring a new way. He didn't come to patch up the old way. He didn't come to fix a few minor problems. He came to eliminate it altogether, to throw it away and replace it with something new. And that new thing was going to be himself. So the first half of the Gospel of Mark, the first eight chapters, Mark will be pointing out who Jesus is. See, the first question you have to answer is, who is he? Well, Mark says clearly, he's the Christ, Messiah of Israel, the anointed one, the promised one who would come to deliver people from their sin, and he is God's very Son. So he's a God-man coming, and that's who he is. The second part of the Gospel of Mark would be, what did he come for? And we'll see that he came to go to the cross, to suffer and die for us, to pay the price for our sins, that we might have forgiveness and redemption. Now, as we've come to these last few sections we've been in, especially the end of chapter 3, verse 6, the Pharisees went out and immediately began conspiring with the Herodians against him as to how they might do what? Destroy him. They don't simply want to silence him, they want him dead. Now, that's a very serious thing, would you agree? I mean, especially when one of the Ten Commandments is something like, thou shalt not kill. Now, they had justified what they were doing in their own minds by believing that he was so blaspheming against God, he was so leading the people astray, that they had the right to kill the heretic. But they were so, so very wrong. And so we come to this place where the focus is still, who is Jesus? There's a massive conflict going on, and Mark wants to begin to show us who Jesus really is and what his plan is. But as he does so, he enters a new section here in verse 7. And this will take us up through chapter 6. He's still in the area of Galilee. So we're still in that section. He hasn't gone to Jerusalem yet. But in this section, he's going to do a new area. So he summarizes what's happened up until now. And then he introduces the disciples to say where it's going to go coming up. So look at with me in chapter 3, verse 7. Jesus withdrew to the sea with his disciples. And a great multitude from Galilee followed, and also from Judea, and from Jerusalem, and from Idumea, and beyond the Jordan, and the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon. A great number of people heard of all that he was doing and came to him. And he told his disciples that a boat should stand ready for him because of the crowd, so that they would not crowd him. For he had healed many, with the result that all those who had afflictions pressed around him in order to touch him. Whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they would fall down before him and shout, "You are the Son of God." And he earnestly warned them not to tell who he was. And he went up on the mountain and summoned those whom he himself wanted, and they came to him. And he appointed 12 so that they would be with him, and that he could send them out to preach and to have authority to cast out the demons. And he appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, and James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James. To them he gave the name Boanerges, which means sons of thunder. And Andrew, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, and James the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Well, there's a lot in this text here, and there's some just a few things I can point out of all. We could spend months on this. I know some have. Some people have come to this section of the 12 and have done a message on each of the 12. Let me ask you a question. Do you get the feeling that that's Mark's point right now? I mean, if Mark wanted us to do a message on the 12, I think he would have given us a lot more of a biographical sketch, don't you? So there's some other reason why he's listing these 12, and right now it's just a snapshot of who they are. He'll build upon them through the rest of the book. So I'm not going to go into great detail now on these guys. There's a number of books you can read on them. John MacArthur wrote a book called 12 Ordinary Men, and there's a number of other books out there that you can read on the background and more than you want to know about each of these guys. But I want to get to the point of, I think, what the text is saying, and I think it breaks down over two sections. Geographically, he starts out in verse 7 saying Jesus withdrew to the sea, and then geographically in verse 13 he went up on the mountain. So first of all, I want you to look with me at the multitudes by the sea and what goes on with these vast multitudes of people, and then I want you to look with me at what happens with the 12 on the mountain. So first of all, the multitudes by the sea, verse 7. Jesus withdrew to the sea with his disciples. Withdrew to the sea. Now, why was that a good idea? Well, if we just left verse 6, what are the Pharisees and the Herodians wanting to do? They want to kill him. Would withdrawal be a good idea right about now? Now, there are some of us who don't think so. There are some of us who are natural-born fighters. And we think it would be more manly to just take them head on right at that moment. But what Jesus did and what we need to learn how to do is he constantly sought for his Father's will. And it was his Father's will at that moment to withdraw. The Gospel of Mark alone lists 11 different occasions where Jesus withdraws. He pulls away from his work either to escape his enemies, to enjoy prayer and solitude, to rest, or give private instruction to his men. On 11 different occasions, he does that. Now, that should speak volumes to those of us in America who act more like Ricochet Rabbit than anything else. Remember that cartoon, Ricochet Rabbit? Let me see if Dan, do you remember Ricochet Rabbit? All right, you're aging yourselves. Thank you very much. And with that, you know, that movie, that bing, 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 was just all over the place. And that's the way we are. We just rush from thing to thing to thing and never a dull moment. Jesus seemed to have a greater balance in his life. He knew when it was time to face things head on, and he knew when it was time to back off and let things either simmer or calm down. And in this particular occasion, when the heat's getting really high, he withdraws. He just wanted to get away a little bit. Now, if Jesus needed at times to withdraw, do we? This addresses an issue, though, and maybe you're not like this, but I find a lot of people like this. For many people who are busy, It's because they're so busy doing stuff, they don't want to slow down to face something that's going on, something internal. See, a lot of folks are great talking about God, and they're great even teaching things about God, but they have a difficult time being alone with God, to just slow down and cease striving and know that He is God. To just rest in His presence and do nothing. Is that hard for you? For a lot of people, doing nothing is quite easy. But for other people, doing nothing is very hard. Because all of a sudden, things start coming up that they don't want to face. And the Lord can start bringing things to their attention. Jesus had nothing in His heart that the Lord needed to bring to His attention. Because He was sinless. But for us, getting alone with God is important. Withdrawing from the conflict and spending some time with the Father is value. But that wasn't the only reason He was withdrawing. By the way, He didn't withdraw out of fear. Jesus never feared man. Oh, that we could say that, right? Jesus never feared man. Jesus was more than willing to stand up and fight at the right moment. He had no problem with calling a spade a spade. He had no problem with telling the Pharisees that they were hypocrites, that they were whitewashed tombs, and they were headed to hell and leading others there with Him. He had no problem with that at all. But that wasn't why He withdrew. He also didn't withdraw because He was afraid of the Romans. Now, certainly with the Herodians now on His case, they could report Him to Rome, and Rome could send the military there, and they could try to come and kill Him right away. Was Jesus afraid that the Romans could come and kill Him? No, of course not. Jesus, even when He was about ready to die, said, "Look, if I wanted to, I could call 72,000 angels down here right now to protect me." Do you think a Roman army could overcome 72,000 angels? Not when one angel killed 185,000 men in the Old Testament. I think Jesus was pretty well secure, that there was nothing He needed to fear from the Romans, nor from the Jews. He didn't withdraw because of fear. He withdrew because it was the Father's plan. And it was not the Father's plan for Jesus to shed humans' blood. It was not His plan to go wipe out the Pharisees. It was not the Father's plan for Him to go kill the Romans. The Father's plan was for Jesus to shed whose blood? His blood. And that was going to be on the Father's timetable. So He withdraws from the conflict to go out and to continue the ministry the Father had given Him. The timing for ultimate confrontation and death on the cross would be there, but it just wasn't yet. Then what was the Father's plan right now? It was for Him to communicate the message of the gospel to the whole nation. Now the application of this is really simple. As Jesus would seek the Father's will on every issue, so should we, right? So, should we seek the Lord on every big decision we make? Yes or no? To take time away to truly seek Him, to not just throw up a prayer to ask God to validate the decision we've already made, but to truly get alone with the Lord, to seek the Word, to seek wise counsel, to pray, to ask God what His next step is, no matter what the cost. Whether it's going head-on into the fight or backing away from the fight, Lord, what do You want me to do? This is a valid and vital thing for us to learn how to do. It's not always manly to fight. Sometimes it's better to move on and continue the work with other people. So it says He withdrew to the sea with His disciples. Now, Mark makes the phrase "His disciples" emphatic in the original text. So he's emphasizing that not only did Jesus withdraw, but His men withdrew with Him. In other words, they are committed to what He's doing. They're following after Him. They're going with Him. They see the conflict developing. They hear Him telling the Pharisees, "Your system is dead and gone. You are passé. You're not the answer anymore. I'm bringing the new answer." They know the Pharisees want to kill Him, and they side with Jesus anyway. They are making a commitment to go with Jesus as He overthrows false religious establishments and brings new wine and new wineskins to the world. They know it's going to cost them, but they've made their decision. We are on Team Jesus, and we're going to be there no matter what. So Jesus withdraws with them to the countryside where He can do more training and minister to more people. Now, what's interesting is Mark doesn't explicitly tell us who the disciples are. He just says he withdrew with his disciples. Well, up till now in Mark's gospel, how many do we know of by name? Do you remember? Five. Remember that? Who were the first ones? Peter and his brother Andrew, and then the other two brothers, James and John, and then the fifth one was a tax collector named Levi or Matthew in all of the other accounts. We know those five for sure because Mark has named them. John's gospel, chronologically backing up a little bit in chapter 1, verse 43 and following, also adds Philip and Nathanael. So there's either five or seven for sure with him right now. Now, the other five that he's going to pick in a few moments more than likely have already been with him, following him, learning from him, observing the miracles, fully aware of what's going on, because he's going to choose them out of the multitudes to be the 12. We'll talk more about the 12 in a moment. So as Jesus withdraws with his disciples to the sea, notice what happens next. And what kind of multitude? A great multitude, a humongous multitude, a gigantic, ridiculous, uncountable number of people. Mark makes that very clear. So get the picture here. On the one hand, the religious leaders and the political revolutionaries of the day are against Jesus. On the other hand, virtually everybody else, all the normal people are what? They're for him. They want to be around him. They want to come and be part and see what's going on in his life and hear what he has to say and observe the miracles and hopefully receive a miracle from him in their own personal life. So notice where these people come from. And Mark does a very powerful, profound picture that he draws here if you had a map. And a great multitude from where first? Galilee. And so Galilee would be the area right where he is. Galilee is the area where the Sea of Galilee is, and all of those cities around it, Capernaum and Nazareth and all of those areas. So the northern part of Israel, called Galilee, a great multitude from there follow him, but also from Judea. Judea is in the south. And so if you look at this map, it goes from Galilee to Judea to Jerusalem to Idumea and beyond the Jordan and then the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon. Now, where is this? Okay, Galilee is the north. Judea is the southern, one of the southern two tribes that were remaining after the ten were taken captive. Jerusalem is the capital of Judea. So he highlights the northern Israel, southern Israel, the capital where the temple was and all of the religious leadership was. Then he talks about Idumea, or you might have heard this name otherwise called Edom. Remember reading about Edom in the Old Testament? There were two sons, Jacob, and his brother's name was what? Esau, and Esau's other name was Edom, and his descendants were called the Edomites. And so Edom was that area, this Edomian area was the very southern end of Israel out in the desert. And so you have this whole land of Esau's ancestors, south and a little bit east of Israel, about 100 miles south of Jerusalem. So you've got Jesus up withdrawing by the sea. You got people from all around there. You got people from Judea and Jerusalem about 100 miles away coming, and people from another 100 miles away coming, all right, further south. By the way, Herod was an Edomian. He was an Edomite. That was his background. And a lot of Jews lived in that land. Then he says, and beyond the Jordan, or sometimes in the Bible you'll see that called the Transjordan. You might remember when the children of Israel came in and they took over the land of Israel, there were 12 tribes, right? And they came in, and when they first came in, they conquered the eastern side of the Jordan, and then they started to cross over, and 2.5 of the tribes said, we want to stay over here. We like this land. You guys go in and take the land. They said, no, you can have that land, but you're going to go help us conquer the whole land first. So all 12 tribes went in and fought and conquered the land as much as they could. 2.5 of the tribes went back over east of the Jordan, the Transjordan, and 9.5 stayed within what is more Israel proper. But all of that land belonged to Israel. Remember that? So you have this Transjordan area where 2.5 of the tribes of Israel would have lived. Then if you go north of Israel and west to the coast, you come to two cities, Tyre and Sidon, also known as Phoenicia. So this is about 50 plus miles north of Galilee. So you've got people from north of Galilee, east of Israel, the whole of Israel and southeast of Israel. And basically, why isn't anybody coming from the west? Because you go out into the sea and you can't go out there. Nobody lives out there except fish. So he's getting what he's saying is everybody from all around Israel, every Jewish person who could possibly hear of Jesus has now heard of him. And they're all represented here by the Sea of Galilee. That's the picture that Mark wants you to get. They're coming from everywhere. A great number of people who heard of all that he was doing and came to him. Note that they just heard. Now, you know, so far, Jesus keeps telling people to be quiet. Don't go spreading all this information. And what did they do? They went and spread it everywhere. Now, honestly, if you were healed of leprosy, would you keep that to yourself? That would be pretty tough, wouldn't it? If you all of a sudden had a hand that was shriveled and it just grew back, would you want to go tell people about that? In fact, could you hide it? Of course not. Word is going to spread far and wide, and that's what happened. It just spread, and it spread like wildfire all over the place. And regardless of what the leaders of Israel thought about Jesus, the people who heard about him are thinking, this sure sounds messianic to us. This sure sounds like something we've never seen or heard of before. This has got to be of God. And they think this is awesome. And they're all coming. And what you see is a picture of Jesus unifying all of Israel around the gospel and his authoritative new covenant. Now in verse 9, and he told his disciples that a boat should stand ready for him because of the crowd so that they would not crowd him. And that's kind of a funny way of saying that, isn't it? It's actually two different Greek words. The crowd was crowding him. So the crowd got really big. Now, for those of you who like to live in an idyllic kind of a world where everything's happy and perfect all the time, this comes crashing down right here. Jesus is saying, look, guys, we have to be practical. We have to take things into consideration. I mean, for example, if we were to plan an outdoor Easter service next spring to try to get multitudes from the city to come, what might we have to take into consideration? It might what? It might rain. Could that be a problem? Yeah, that could be a real problem. So you have to plan for those things. So Jesus realizing as this crowd is growing, now imagine a crowd that's tens of thousands, if not 100,000 or more, all jamming up, and here Jesus is by the sea. Where can he go? Well, he could have walked on water if he had chosen to, but he's not going to. So Jesus comes up with a plan, and he says, have a boat right here ready in case the crowd gets crazy. And then I'll just go into the boat, and I can teach them from there. Now, the word crowd means basically a mob. All right, it's a particular Greek word that he uses. It's a group of people jammed together, literally. So he talks about this jammed together people, and it says when they're crowding him, it's the Greek word that was used of crushing grapes. So we're not just talking about people just getting up near him. We're talking about the kind of crowd that could absolutely crush him. Why were they doing that? Well, the text tells us because they had afflictions. This is a word that was used of a whip or a scourge. So imagine getting a cat of nine tails, which was what they used to beat people with in those days, and having that kind of affliction, whatever you are experiencing, it's excruciating painful. You are going through this horrific thing, and it is just driving you nuts, and you hear there's a guy that if you go touch him, you're going to be healed. What are you going to do? Now, about now, who are you focused on? Who's most important in your life? You. Do you care about the other people who also have afflictions that want to get near to Jesus? No. You are number one. And you are going to push, shove, kick, gouge, elbow, whatever you got to do. I mean, this is like the ultimate fighting championships going on to see who's going to get closest to Jesus. And they're pushing and shoving and elbowing and scratching and clawing. And Jesus goes, we got a problem, men. Get me a boat. Is that a good idea? Are you with me on that? So this is what Jesus, you're going to see this boat come up more and more. There's several times in other Gospels he's going to step into that boat when he needs to. The people want to touch him. Why? They believe that they touch him, his magical powers will come to them. We're going to see that in a couple of chapters when the woman who has the hemorrhage for all those years goes up and touches him and she's healed. So word is spreading around. It's not that he touches you. You just touch him and you'll be healed. So imagine this. Like you were at a rock concert. Have you ever heard about those rock concerts where all of a sudden people get crushed by the crowd? Or soccer games where the crowd gets out of hand and all of a sudden someone gets trampled? Or Black Friday sales? Have you heard of some of those? Where people have actually been killed. I mean, seriously, just to get a discount. Can you imagine that? I'm going to get 50% off that TV. I think I'll kill somebody for it. I mean, isn't that absurd? But that's what kind of the crowd mentality is. And Jesus is aware of that. Now, he's not afraid of the crowd. He doesn't believe they can crush him. If Jesus wanted to put a force field around himself, could he have? Sure, but he's modeling for us. Just be practical, folks. Don't be hyper-spiritual. Don't just go, well, just trust God. Have you ever heard people say that? Well, don't be practical like that. Just trust God. I mean, if God doesn't want you dead, you're not going to die. Listen, God not only says, trust him, he says, don't test him. Don't purposely jump off a cliff and then complain later, God, why didn't you catch me? That's just stupid, right? And so don't do stupid things in the name of faith. Jesus wasn't going to be like that. Jesus trusted his Father, but he also trusted his brain to make a safe decision for himself and for whoever, for who else? Everyone in the crowd. Now, if he gets back to where they can't come up and touch him, what are they going to do? They're going to back off a little bit. They're going to start stop trampling each other. So he's got others in his mind as well. So the Lord plans for every contingency. Wise, detailed planning is godly. Now, why did Jesus do this? Because the point here is not the miracles. The point still, then and forever will be, the message. Right? It's not the miracle. The miracle is simply to validate the message. It's a confirming sign that the message is truly from God. And that's what Jesus is more concerned with. He came to preach to the multitudes that they might hear the gospel of the kingdom. The physical healing was just the precursor of the spiritual healing he wanted them to have. So now, whenever the gospel goes forth with power, guess what? If the gospel is going forth with power, who wants to stop it? Satan. Let me read a couple of verses to you. 1 Corinthians 16, verses 8 and 9. Paul, writing in the Corinthians, says, I will remain in Ephesus until Pentecost, for a wide door for effective service has opened to me, and there are many adversaries. Do you know that every time there's a wide open door for effective ministry, the devil's going to do everything he can to stop it? He does not want the gospel to go forward. He does not want people to come to know the truth. So he will do everything he can to stop them. 1 Thessalonians 2:18, Paul wrote to the Thessalonians saying, we wanted to come to you, I, Paul, more than once, and yet Satan hindered us. Satan will try to stop the messenger from getting someplace to deliver the message. That's why we pray earnestly for missionaries and others who are going to far countries, because they are facing opposition. And by the way, so are you. If you determine today, because of this text, to go out and be an ambassador for Christ, if you say, Lord, I'm going to be obedient. I'm not going to fear man anymore. I'm going to go out and follow Jesus. I'm going to go out and fish for men. I'm going to tell people about the kingdom of God and salvation through Jesus Christ. That's what I'm going to do. Guess what? Somebody out there is going to hate your guts. And he's going to do everything he can to stop you. He will distract you. He will thwart you. He will have people mock you. He will threaten you. He will do whatever he can to keep you from doing that. He would much rather you be a comfortable Christian sitting in church on Sunday and going home and doing nothing than he would be for you to go out and decide, I'm going to go make a difference for Jesus Christ. So the very next thing we see in verse 11, whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they would fall down before him and shout, you are the Son of God. And he earnestly warned them not to tell who he was. What are unclean spirits? What's another name for them? Demons. Fallen angels. A third of heaven that fell, rebelled with Satan, and turned against God. When they turned against God, they became unclean, immoral, evil, wicked. They are debauched. They are crooked. They are perverse. They will do whatever they've got to do to trick and deceive and lead astray. They are immoral in every aspect. They are opposed to God and everything He stands for. But I want you to see something Mark points out here in the text, and it has to do with the verbs and then the verb tenses. It says, whenever the unclean spirits saw Him, they would fall down before Him and they would shout. Now the word saw is not your normal word for seeing something. It's an intense stare. So imagine these unclean spirits, these fallen angels, when they were originally created, were in the presence of God. They were there when certain angels were flying into God's presence saying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory." They were there. They saw that. They saw the holiness of God. They know who God is. And they rebelled. And they are now AWOL. They are rebellious soldiers. They have turned away from their commander-in-chief. They're off on their own mission doing their own thing. And all of a sudden, they see the commander coming. What do you do when you're AWOL and you see the general on his way? You're staring at him. Where is he coming? Does he see me? What's going on? And that's what they're doing. These guys are like a bunch of cockroaches in your garage at night when you turn the light on. And they just want to get out of there. And they see him coming. And they're like, "Oh, no." And when he comes close, they just fall down. And they just slam themselves to the ground, literally is what he says. They fell prostrate. But they're slamming their bodies on the ground before him. And then it says, and they were shouting. This is a word for an intense, shrieking kind of a scream. This isn't just some guys, some demon-possessed men kind of going, "Oh, you are the Son of God." No, 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 no. These are guys that they stare at Jesus, they see Him coming, and they start slamming their bodies on the ground, drawing attention to themselves with this demonic, evil, otherworldly, shrieking scream, "You are the Son of God!" This would have caused panic in a crowd, do you think? I mean, people are like, "What in the world is going on here? These demon-possessed people are pointing Him out this way? What's the deal?" And by the way, they're all imperfect verbs, which means they kept on doing it over and over and over and over again, making a spectacle. Then their message, "You are the Son of God," "You" is emphatic. "You and you alone are the Son of God." Wow. Do these demons have sound doctrine? Yeah. See, they have orthodoxy. They don't have orthopraxy. They know the truth. They just won't live it. And so they're shouting out, making a spectacle. And by the way, up to this point in the Gospel of Mark, they're the only ones that know who Jesus is. Nobody else seems to get it right. Mark said in chapter 1, verse 1, He's the Son of God, and so far the demons are the only ones who recognize it. Did the Pharisees see that He was the Son of God? Do the disciples yet recognize He's the Son of God? Does the crowd know that He's the Son of God? No. And quite frankly, if we were honest, we don't see it very well. Because if we did, we would fall down and we would shout out from a humble heart desiring to exalt Him that "You are the Son of God." We wouldn't care what anybody thought about us. If we really knew that Jesus Christ was the Son of God, we would follow Him no matter what He asked us to do. There would be no price we wouldn't pay. There would be no sacrifice we wouldn't make. We would not care one bit if we ever got rewarded for it. We would just do it. Isn't that true? Are you with me on that? Can I get an amen from anybody? That's the way it ought to be, beloved. But do we really see Him that way? Why is it that demons see Him more clearly than we do? Mark's going to keep building on that case throughout the rest of his text until at the very end somebody gets it. He really is the Son of God. And in verse 12, He earnestly warned them that they should not tell anybody who He was. Earnestly warned them means He censured them, He rebuked them, or literally, He threatened to punish them if they didn't shut up. Wow, that's serious, don't you think? Now, if they have the right message, why doesn't Jesus want them to spread it? Now, this has led to lots of dialogue and debate down through the centuries, and there's a myriad of different answers possibly to that, but I want to tell you something right here. It wasn't just the demons that He told to be quiet. In chapter 1, verse 34, He told the demons that, but in chapter 5, verse 43, He told His disciples after He raised a little girl from the dead, He gave strict orders for them to tell no one. In chapter 7, verse 36, He heals a deaf person, and He tells all the people who saw it to tell no one. And in chapter 8, verse 30, when Simon Peter finally says, "You are the Christ," and the first half of the book is done and the answer is given, who is this man? He is the Christ, the Messiah of Israel, the Savior of the world. And when that answer finally comes forth, Jesus told them to tell no one. Why? Well, first of all, why did he tell the demons to be quiet? Well, I think there's one real simple answer. It's right easy in front of us. He doesn't want to be in league with demons. He doesn't need them as their PR firm. Now, just a few verses later in this chapter, he's going to be accused by the Pharisees of being in league with Satan. He's going to be accused of joining up with Satan and being on the same team. So he doesn't want that to even be remotely close to the truth. So he tells them to shut up. There's another reason, though, too. He doesn't want word to get out too soon. What would happen if all the crowd understood at that moment he really was the Messiah of Israel, the Son of God, the King of Kings? What would they do? They would want to make him what? King right then. And what would they expect him to do? Kill the Romans, get the enemies off their back, elevate Israel to its rightful place in the world. Is that what he came to do the first time? No, that wasn't the point. See, if the crowds knew who he was, they would have demanded to become king right away. What is the reason why he doesn't want this word spreading? Because he doesn't want it to interfere with his ultimate plan, and that plan was to go to the what? The cross. Look at Mark chapter 9, verse 9 with me just for a moment. I want you to see a very critical verse. It's a really, really important verse. They were coming down from the mountain. He gave them orders not to relate to anyone what they had seen. And the very next phrase, until the Son of Man, what? Rose from the dead. What's his point? In chapter 10, verse 45, he would say this, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a what? A ransom for many." See, the point is he has to go to the cross. If he reveals his identity too soon, they're going to want to make him king. They want to thwart the cross. So he has them silenced. He did not come to overthrow Roman rule. He had bigger goals than that. He wasn't there simply to get rid of Rome and to elevate Israel. He came to overthrow sin, to overthrow darkness, to overthrow slavery, to overthrow rebellion to God, to overthrow the devil and his demons. And Christ at that moment was not concerned with national issues, but spiritual issues. It wasn't about political overthrow, it was submission of the heart. He wasn't concerned about your current situation, about your salvation. Do you understand what I'm saying here? There are bigger fish to fry. Jesus has his priorities. It would have been easier, but it wasn't the Father's will for him just to take over the world right then. He came to die. And finally, after he does go to the cross, in Mark 15:39, it says, "When the centurion who was standing right in front of him saw the way he breathed his last, he said, 'Truly, this man was the Son of God.'" Do you know that's the first time in Mark's gospel someone other than a demon recognizes who Jesus is? At the cross. Up until the cross and resurrection, his identity had to be incognito, because that wasn't the Father's plan yet. So, well, if Jesus' plan is not to have demons proclaim the gospel, what is his plan then? That takes us to part two here, the 12 on the mountain. We'll look at this quickly. "And he went up on the mountain." So first Jesus withdraws from the Pharisees and he goes off to the sea and gets this gigantic multitude. Now he withdraws from the multitude and he goes up on it, and he, Mark very clearly says, the mountain. We don't know which the mountain it is, but apparently it's a mountain that Jesus had gone to before. And so he goes up on the mountain. And what does he do up there? Well, we know in a moment he's going to select the 12. But what Luke tells us is very instructive, because in Luke chapter 6, verse 12, it tells us that Jesus went up on that mountain and he spent the entire night doing what? Praying. He was praying, seeking his Father, seeking the Father's will. Before every big decision, Jesus prayed. Shouldn't we do the same? By the way, how many of our decisions are big? All of them. That's why we pray without ceasing. That's why we just come before the Lord constantly in every decision. We don't want to make one decision outside of the Father's will. We want to develop a sensitive heart. But when it comes to these massive, huge decisions, it would do us well to spend a season in prayer. I don't know how many of you have ever spent an entire night in prayer. I did kind of once. One night I was by my bed when I was a single man. I was on my knees praying and I fell asleep. And I woke up the next morning and I was still praying. So I guess I prayed all night. Well, we ought to do this more often. In fact, other parts of the world, they do. Christians in other parts of the world practice this. In Korea, when Korean parents have a child that goes wayward, heads off into immoral things, etc., those parents will get on their knees and pray all night long, crying out to God that He would bring their children back to their senses. There's an awareness at times in our lives how much we need the Father. And if Jesus needed the Father before a big decision, oh, how much more so do we? So He goes up on the mountain and He summoned those whom He Himself wanted. The word summon is an interesting word. It means to call toward. In other words, to separate from whom you're with and make a choice. I'm calling you out of that crowd onto this team. And that's the word that Mark chooses to use. So after praying to His Father, He summons the 12 out of the multitudes. And He chooses 12 out of them. Those plural. In other words, He's not just appointing or summoning individuals. He's summoning a team. You're getting this picture here that Jesus wants a team. And He says that they were those that He Himself wanted. It was His choice, not theirs. They didn't say, "Jesus, we want you." Jesus said, "I want you. I choose you. I call you to be mine." He tells them later in John's Gospel, He says, "You did not choose me, but I," what? "I chose you." And the same thing is true of us. Ephesians 1 makes that very clear. Romans 8 makes that very clear. In eternity past, God foreknew and He predestined and He called and He justified and He glorified. God did all of it. He called us out of where we were and He called us to Himself because He wanted us. Isn't that a great thing to say? He says, out of all the multitudes, Jesus wanted these 12. He willed them. He desired them. He had a desire for them to be on His team. There is a human element here. And they came to Him. They responded to the call. And the verb "came" is another interesting word. It's hard to translate. It's a compound verb in the Greek language that means they went off from, they went away from, they departed, they made a break. So here they were up until this point. And early on, they'd heard Him preach and they'd followed Him to a certain degree. And later He comes to the point where He calls them and they leave everything to follow Him. And now He's calling them to say, "Okay, guys, now it's full time. No holding back. No turning around." Like the song, "I have decided to," what? "Follow Jesus." No turning back, no turning back. That's what's going on right now. And He wanted them and He called them and they made that decision. Do they know the danger? Do they know how much of a revolutionary this guy is? Do they know that he's hated? Yes or no? And they choose to go anyway. And they came to Him. And He appointed 12. Literally the word means He made 12 or brought into existence or created literally the 12. Why not 13? Why not 11? Why not 70? Why not 120? Why not 5,000? Why the 12? Isn't that an interesting question? Well, what would that say to the nation of Israel? Multitudes have come from where? Everywhere. All of Israel is represented. The north, the south, east, everywhere. All of Israel is represented. And out of Israel, He appoints the 12. What is He doing? He's declaring judgment on old Israel. 12 tribes. You're all sinful. You're all debauched. The old way is going. I'm bringing in new. I'm not going to have old wineskins anymore. I've got new wine and new wineskins and new leadership. And these 12 are my leaders. I'm appointing these guys to take you forward. And after Jesus is dead and resurrected and gone to heaven, they will be the ones who will carry the movement. And so these are the guys. In fact, in Ephesians 2, verse 19 and 20, it says they are the foundation. In Luke 22, 28 through 30, it says they will rule over the 12 tribes of Israel in the future millennial kingdom. In Revelation 21, 12 through 14, it has them memorialized in the New Jerusalem as those that are the ones that are sitting in judgment over and ruling for God. He appointed the 12. He's bringing judgment on Israel, and he's setting up a new system. Why did he call them? He says, so that they would be with him. That's a beautiful statement, isn't it? There's three things he says here. So that they would be with him, so that he could send them out to preach and have authority to cast out the demons. Be with him. What is that? That's personal relationship. Jesus wanted them to be with him. Now, some people get kind of weird here and they start going off on, oh, don't tell me that Jesus was lonely and he needed companionship. Well, hang on a second, folks. Is loneliness a sin? Did God create us for fellowship? When Adam was created and he was without Eve, what did God say? It's not what? Good for him to be what? Alone. Why do we have such a hard time seeing Jesus as human? He wanted them. He wanted them to be with him. Now we know he also wanted them to be with him so he could train them. But I want to tell you something, folks. Before you can go out and work for the Lord, you got to know the Lord. You got to walk with him. You got to spend time with him. See, he wants to work in you before he works through you. And this is the thing that's so missing in American Christianity, because we're ricochet rabbit, right? We're so busy going, going, doing, doing, doing that we don't have the time just to sit and be. We're more Martha than Mary. Can you admit that? Anybody here know what I'm talking about? Yes or no? And the Lord here is saying, I just want you to be with me. That's the good thing. Come and be with me. Come learn from me. Come hear me. Come watch me. Let me model for you what I want you to do. Then, he says, I can send you out to preach, and that was the primary thing. Then why was this other thing about him giving them authority to cast out the demons? Well, that was because he wanted them to preach, and then he wanted to have proof that what they were preaching was true. God hasn't called all of us to run around the world and cast out demons. These were signs of the apostles. These were powerful things that they had. These were miracles they could perform, and they did so on behalf of Jesus. So he's giving them his authority to go out with his message and his miracles so that the world might know who he really is. So he appointed the 12. Then he names them. Let's just run through this list really quick, right? And basically, you know who these guys are? They're a bunch of nobodies. Isn't that great? God chose a bunch of nobodies to rule the world for him. That gives me hope. 1 Corinthians 1 says, hey, there's not many mighty, not many noble according to the flesh. You guys are a bunch of losers, is basically what he says. Do we have a hard time admitting that? You know, it's kind of the funny part of that is when we're alone or we're in a big crowd and all of a sudden we feel like we're about this big and we feel like everybody else is important and we're nothing, we admit that. We go, oh my goodness, I'm nobody. But other times we think we're hot stuff. God just says, look, I can use nobodies in a mighty way. And so here's the list. Let's go through this list. By the way, the list is given in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Acts. Every time it lists them in three groups of four. It always has the same guy at the beginning of each group. The first group is Peter, James, Andrew, and John. The second group is Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, and Thomas. The third group is James, Thaddeus, Simon, and Judas. Peter is always first. Judas is always last. Each group, there's a decreasing amount of information we know about them. Each group, there seems to be a decreasing closeness to the Lord. It's like the first group was very close to him, and the second group not so close, and the third group seemed. So we don't know a lot about them, but here's what I love about this. He not only gives them names, he gives them nicknames. What's that tell you? When you give somebody a nickname, it's usually because they're a close friend, right? These are Jesus' friends. These are guys that he's hanging out with. They're the guys he's spending time with. He gives them names. He gives them nicknames. He has reasons for these nicknames. Sometimes a positive reason. Like Simon, he gave him the name Peter. What's the word Peter mean? Rock. Simon, the mealy-mouthed guy who's later going to deny me, I call you Rock. Why? Because that's what you need to become. Isn't that great? So Simon, your nickname's Rock, because that's what you got to be, buddy. I'm going to count on you, and later I'm going to build the church around you and your profession of faith. Then he goes on, he says that there's James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James. James and John. To them he gave the name Boanerges, which means sons of thunder. Now what do these guys do for a living? They're fishermen. So get this, fishermen with a bad attitude. And here these guys are, and they're ready to call fire down and destroy people. And then, you can imagine guys like that. So here you've got Peter, the guy with a foot-shaped mouth. And you got his brother, who we don't know a whole lot more about, except he goes out and brings people to Jesus. Then you've got James and John, who are trying to call lightning down on people's heads. Then you've got, after Andrew, the brother of Peter, you've got a guy named Philip. His name means lover of horses. Well, that's interesting. Then you got Bartholomew. That's not really his name. That's kind of a nickname. Bartholomew means son of Ptolemy. His real name is Nathaniel, according to the other gospel recordings of him. And then you have a guy named Matthew, whose other name is Levi, and he was a what? Tax collector. And then you have Thomas. And by the way, in John 11:16, he's called Thomas Didymus, or Thomas the Twin. So Thomas is a twin. That's all we know about Thomas, except what is Thomas famous for? Doubting. So you got doubting Thomas. Then you got James, the son of Alphaeus. We don't know much about him except Mark 16:40 says his mother was a follower of Christ. And he was also called James the Less, or James the Little Guy. Wouldn't that be great? Hey, little guy. Wouldn't that just bless your heart to be called that your whole life? Hey, twin. Hey, little guy. Hey, horse lover. This is a ridiculous group of people. Hey, tax collector, rebel, good for nothing, we hate you. And then, on top of that, there's Thaddeus, Judas, son of James. He's called in Luke 6:16. You know what Thaddeus really means? You're going to love this. Mama's boy. Not classic. So they gave him another name, Lebbeus, which means heart child. You know what that is? Another name for mama's boy. Good grief. Are you getting the idea? This is a group of losers? This is unbelievable. And Simon the Zealot, or the Canaanian, is really what the word says, but it's not as if Canaanian. It's a root of a Hebrew word for zealous. So he's a political revolutionary who wants to overthrow Rome, and they were famous for carrying little daggers. And if they could see a Roman soldier nearby with no one around, they would stab him and kill him and then walk away silently. And he's on the Jesus team. And by the way, he's on there with a tax collector who rebelled against the Jews. What do you think might happen between those two if they were left alone? We got problems, folks. And after that, you got Judas Iscariot, who Mark forewarns the readers betrays him. You get the picture? Names and nicknames, a bunch of nobodies. It's almost as if Mark's rubbing it in. It's almost as if Mark wants us to understand God is going to build his kingdom, and he doesn't need superstars to do it. We kind of have a weird cult of the superstar in American Christianity today, and it's really sad. God wants to use a bunch of nobodies. What did these guys ultimately do? Well, all of them except for one died as martyrs. John was the only one that we don't know of actually being martyred, but he was exiled out to the island of Patmos. We went there on our recent trip to Israel a few years ago, and he went out there from which he wrote the book of Revelation. He also wrote the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and died somewhere, probably in his 90s or so. Everybody else suffered and died. Peter was crucified upside down. His brother Andrew was crucified, but he asked that he would be tied instead of nailed to the cross. Because he wanted to prolong the suffering. James was the one recorded in Scripture. He was executed by Herod Agrippa. Philip was reportedly stoned to death in Asia Minor, but not before multitudes heard him preach Christ and came to faith. There's different traditions about his buddy Nathaniel, or Bartholomew, how he died, but some say he was bound and thrown into the sea. Others say he was crucified. Matthew, they claim, was burned at the stake. Thomas went to India, founded the church in India that still thrives today. They say he was killed with a spear. According to some records, James, the son of Alphaeus, was stoned to death by the Jews. Simon the Zealot was sawn in half, like Isaiah was. And Thaddeus went to Turkey and preached the gospel and was clubbed to death. That's Team Jesus. Men who understood who the Messiah was. The mission he gave them to share. And guess what, beloved? God has given us that same mission, hasn't he? The Great Commission. Go into all the world and make what? Disciples of all the nations. You say, but I'm not anybody. I'm not gifted. I can't do that. God doesn't need you to be a somebody. God just needs you to come spend time with Jesus. Later in Acts chapter 4, as we wrap this up, the apostles are out preaching and they heal a man. And the leaders of Israel pull them aside and threaten them and tell them not to do this anymore. And as they defend themselves, people recognize. They said, how is it that these unlearned fishermen, these uneducated nobodies, how is it that they are able to do these things? And in this phrase, they recognize that they had been with Jesus. The answer is, be with Jesus. He can change you. He can empower you. He can work through you just like he did these men. Probably won't call you to martyrdom. I'm not expecting that. But if he does, would it be worth it? Absolutely. There's a world out there that needs to hear about Jesus. 12 unlikely men, he called, commissioned, and confirmed, and now he's calling us. Will we follow Jesus? Will we fish for Jesus?